This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
So I'm talking to Dr. Bob Wong.
Yeah, so I'm a professor of behavioural and evolutionary biology based at Monash University in Melbourne.
The last time I talked to you, you said that your area of special interest is sex in an evolutionary context. Is that still true?
Yes, that's right. So my area of expertise is on reproductive behaviours in particular and how organisms, including humans, undergo the process of mate choice.
And so I contacted you today because I wanted to talk about why we observe same-sex attraction in humans and also potentially some other animals. I understand the explanations differ between species. I kind of just wanted to establish what a person who is listening to this might think in terms of evolution. So something that's a very common mindset, for example. So like if you're not somebody who studied evolution, you know, beyond high school, if you haven't taken science, you know, into a tertiary sort of level of education, what you might know about evolution is you might understand inheritance. So you understand that traits get passed on from parent to offspring through reproduction. And you might understand natural selection. So you understand that certain traits benefit survival and reproduction more, and they tend to be passed on more. And other traits tend to not benefit survival and reproduction, and they tend to be passed on less. And other traits, they tend not to be passed on at all because they are detrimental. And so you kind of think in that lens that same-sex attraction seems like something that wouldn't be passed on, because if a individual is same-sex attracted, then that would probably lower the rate at which they're reproducing. Now, obviously, we do see same-sex attraction, not just in humans, but in some other animals as well. So clearly there's something else going on here. So I kind of want to throw over to you, how would you explain to a person who has that understanding of evolution, that sort of very basic understanding, how would you explain to them some of the ways in which we see same-sex attraction be maintained and passed on in certain, first off in humans?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. The reality is that in most cases, when it comes to humans, one might expect that homosexuals would reproduce less than heterosexuals. So it does present a bit of an evolutionary conundrum as to how a trait like same-sex attraction might be maintained in the human population. And researchers have actually looked into this. And what they have actually found is that homosexual men, the relatives on the mother's side, tend to have higher fertility than the relatives on the paternal side. So that suggests that there might be a genetic component whereby perhaps the reduced reproductive outputs of homosexuals are counterbalanced by higher fertility in some of those maternal relatives.
So that's kind of like the gene has two purposes. So like in men, it produces one type of behavior, but in women, it produces another type of behavior, and that it increases a woman's fitness. And so that's how it's passed on.
Yeah, so there is an idea in evolutionary biology that sometimes traits that may at first seem detrimental even for individual fitness could still be maintained if it's linked to something that could be positive. So in this case, when we think about passing on of genes, there are a couple of ways that genes can be passed on. They can be passed on through direct reproduction, so by leaving your genes behind in your direct descendants, or they can be also passed on through having genes in common with your relatives. And this particular piece of research, published some 15 years ago, suggested there might be something on the X chromosome, because of course in men, and this is a study looking at homosexuality in men of course we have the X and the Y chromosome, and we get the X from the mother's side. So there's a probability of sharing X chromosome in common with the maternal relatives. So these studies actually found that along the maternal line, there is actually an increased fecundity or fertility.
You were talking to me about how one of the largest predicting factors over whether men will exhibit same-sex attraction is whether they have older brothers. And I've also heard around about something called the gay uncle hypothesis, which is where if a brother is same-sex attracted, and so they typically don't have their own children, they can contribute resources to raising their siblings' children. Can you talk to me a little bit about that and the gay uncle hypothesis, and whether you think it's an accurate description of that phenomenon?
Sure, I might just backtrack a little bit, and just talk a little bit about genes and environment, how they can both be important. Do you mind if I do that? And then I guess you can then splice bits and pieces, because I think it needs a little bit of context. Are you okay with me doing that?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Okay, so we know that the factors responsible for sexuality is quite complex. And when it comes to homosexuality, there seems to be both a genetic and an environmental component. And we see that because of earlier studies that have been done looking at twins. So studies have looked at both identical twins and also non-identical twins. And they've done these studies both in males and also in female twins. And what they find is that if one twin happens to be gay, and if they are identical, then the chance that the other twin also happens to be gay is much higher in the case of identical twins compared to non-identical twins. But it's not 100%. So it does suggest that there is a genetic component, but then the fact that it's not 100% in the case of identical twins also highlights that environment plays an important role. Now, in the context of environment, we know that the most consistent biodemographic predictor of sexuality, at least in men, is the number of older biological brothers. So there was a study that was carried out some years ago. It was quite a large sample of several hundred men, where they actually looked at this so-called birth order effect. And what they wanted to disentangle was to try and work out what aspect of the environment is actually contributing to homosexuality in men. And of course, when we think about the environment, we can think of the environment after a child is born, so their rearing environment, and also we can think about the environment inside the mother's womb. So these researchers wanted to try and disentangle this fraternal birth order effect, to try and figure out what is the actual environment that's actually influencing sexuality. So if it's due to rearing environment, then all brothers reared with a participant, whether they're biological brothers, whether they're older or younger, and also the length of time, all of those things should predict sexual orientation. But if it's due to something that's inside the mother's womb, then only biological older brothers should predict sexual orientation. And that's exactly what they found. They found that the number of older biological brothers predicted sexual orientation. So each older brother basically increases your chances of turning out to be gay.
And of course, this is chance-based because, you know, I know some men who have, you know, a couple of older brothers and they're straight. I have no older brothers and I'm gay. So
yes, exactly. So it's important to bear that in mind. I think with scientific studies, there's a tendency for people when we look at scientific studies to either say that this study must be true because my experiences accord with that, or that this study is not true because my personal experiences don't accord with that. So when you do statistical analysis, it comes down to probabilities, and it's this result is statistically significant. So I'm pretty much like yourself. I'm the oldest in the family. I have two younger sisters. There are no older biological brothers, but of course I am also gay. So it doesn't mean that if you're the oldest one that you're not going to be. And similarly, if you happen to be the youngest of, say, five brothers, that it's inevitable that you're going to turn out to be gay. So the statistics based on a sample size of several hundred people show that the number of older biological brothers is predictive of sexual orientation in men, but of course it's not inevitable.
So if the key factor might be the environment inside the womb, might that be an example of a maternal effect gene, where the trait expressed by the individual is not necessarily due to the individual's own genes, but the genes of their parent?
Yeah, so in this particular case, the authors of that study actually suggested, and of course this is not tested, they were arguing that it's the actual environment of the womb itself, and perhaps the mothers in those cases recognizing the first or the earlier male fetuses as being different or foreign and responding to that fetus in a particular way that has a memory effect, so that when she's pregnant again with a subsequent male embryo, then there's some sort of response that's taking place there. We know that the maternal environment inside the womb can be really influential. And once again, studies of twins provide some really useful insights. So they found, for example, looking at studies of twins in Finland during pre-industrial times based on birth, death and marriage records, they were able to track the reproductive fate and also survival of twins. And what they found was that if you're part of a male-female twin pairing, it was actually bad news for you if you happened to be the female, because those individuals were less likely to be married and they actually had had fewer children. So perhaps I think it underscores that the natal environment, whether you're on your own or whether you're sharing the womb with somebody else, can affect you in ways that can manifest later on in life.
People like to sometimes think of evolutionary explanations as involving an evolutionary purpose. Is there a benefit to same-sex attraction as a phenotype, like a fitness benefit? So, like, does it raise the fitness of siblings? Does it raise the fitness of, you know, the family as a whole as an observed trait? So, like, what would be the purpose of same-sex attraction as a trait in raising fitness either for the self or the group?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we earlier talked about how the relatives on the mother's side of gay men tend to have higher fertility. So that suggests that there might be a fertility or fecundity benefit. But of course, when you have additional individuals in the family unit helping to look after offspring, that can be another additional benefit. And there is a hypothesis out there that suggests that you can have persistence of homosexuality in the environment or in human societies, because those males, by not being reproductive themselves, could actually play a really important role in raising non-descendant kin. So it's an important fact to remember that perpetuation of genes can occur not only through direct reproduction, but also by helping your non-descendant kin to survive, for example, your nieces and your nephews. So by sticking around and being available to help contribute to their survival, you are also passing on genes that that you may have in common with your non-descendant relatives, such as your nieces and nephews.
We've talked a little bit about same-sex attraction as an evolutionary trait in humans. As I understand it, we see it in multiple places across the animal kingdom, and the explanation for why they arise there can be wildly different. So can you give me, just as much as you can, some of your favorite examples of same-sex attraction in the animal kingdom and why you think they're fascinating?
Right. Look, I think the first thing to point out is that I think humans are relatively vanilla when we compare ourselves to other non-human animals. There's actually remarkable reproductive and sexual diversity prevalent across the animal world. There are numerous examples, such as species that mimic, where males actually mimic females. So giant cuttlefish are a good example of that, where you have males that compete with each other vigorously for access to female matings, but then you've also got female mimic males that try and sneak in basically gliding under cover to try and secure mating. So you see a lot of some really remarkable examples of reproductive diversity. There are species that are hermaphroditic, that have both functional male and female parts. But in terms of same-sex behaviors, there are numerous examples. So, and the adaptive or evolutionary explanations for why they occur can vary considerably as well, depending on species. So to use a few examples, bed bugs, those of us who have unfortunately spent time in budget hotels or in backpacker places would be familiar with bed bugs and their nasty bites. But they're also very well known among evolutionary biologists because they engage in a form of reproductive behavior known as traumatic insemination. So the intromittent organs, or the penises, as it were, of bed bugs are like hypodermic syringes. And they basically, the males will stab females to try and inseminate them, and the sperm would then make their way to the female's reproductive tract. But males don't just stab females, they also stab each other. And in that case, the male stabs another male so that its sperm can make its way to the reproductive tract of the male that it has stabbed. So when that male subsequently tries to mate with a female, some of the male sperm of the stabber ends up fertilizing the female's eggs. By contrast, you have examples like bonobos, which are a great ape. They're a kind of chimpanzee. And same-sex behavior in that particular species is very much tied around social bonds, maintaining of social bonds. So both males and females of bonobos engage in same-sex behaviors at very high frequency, as often as once every 2 hours, for example. So they're just two examples of same-sex behaviors. Another one that I can think of are some species of birds that engage in very elaborate courtship behaviors. So here in Australia, we have birds called rifle birds, which are native to the far north of the country. And in that particular species, males engage in a really ostentatious display that involves a lot of wing flapping. And what we know in that particular species is that males, as they're growing up, they will actually apprentice off each other and actually display to each other. And then, of course, there's also been work done on fish called guppies. And what we found in guppies is that when individuals are raised in same-sex environments compared to mixed-sex environments, they're actually more likely to engage in same-sex behaviors as well. So that, I think, once again, sheets home the importance of the environment in shaping these kinds of behaviors. We also have flatworms, which are hermaphrodites, which means that they have both male and female reproductive organs at the same time. And researchers have found that flatworms actually engage in penis fencing. So flatworms are unusual. Well, compared to humans, they're unusual in the sense that they have two intermittent organs. And the flatworms will actually rear their bodies up and try and stab each other with their penises to try and inseminate, their opponent, for choice of a better word, because in that case, both individuals want to contribute their sperm and, of course, benefit from having offspring, but neither of them actually want to have the increased energetic cost or energetic burden that would normally go into rearing up the developing embryos inside their bodies. So you've got some really bizarre behaviors taking place among individuals of the same sex in the animal world.
Yes, thanks for giving us some of those some of those examples. Those are fascinating, also potentially a little bit gruesome. I mean, nature is like that. But thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Okay, all the best.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.